forces, they would have to be the same size, same muscle capacity, etc., etc., and would probably look like people on this planet, but, you know, one race versus another. In other words, they wouldn't look like something you saw on Star Wars, if you remember the movie. Yeah, Dick, what do you think of that?
I'm not so sure of that one, Rich. There were five major mass extinctions on this planet. And what was the dominant species before each one of those mass extinctions was a very different looking animal. So, of all the planets out there that are in the Goldilocks zone that have our particular sequence of ice ages and mass extinctions, maybe. I think you and I, if we thought that way, Rich, we're thinking much too anthropomorphically, much too like ourselves. You're implying that, there's a religious implication here. If I was a secular person and no religion was involved, and I'm just allowing hydrocarbon life to proceed any way it wants to in the particular conditions, a very minor difference in the amount of water, the average temperature, where the land is versus where the water is, and whatever, very minor differences could have made a very large difference. So, I don't think so, Rich. But I'm just telling you, gut feel. I got nothing to base it on. So, it would be too coincidental, in my opinion, of all the possibilities. That's about as far as I go on that one. Okay, I think Alan wanted to say something. KC2, Victor, correction, here we go. KC2, Zebra, Uncle Mike. K2RIW, go ahead, Alan.
Some audio here on my monitor. It sounds like I'm coming in very low.
You came in rather well, Alan. Not to worry. Fishkill. About to find out how far away that is. When I in the world. Oh, there it is. 58 miles. If you wanted to, Alan, if you put up an antenna with a little bit of gain aimed in this direction, is there enough clearance in your direction down here? I think you'd have to be going roughly southwest, correction, southeast. If you were willing to put up enough antenna, do you believe you'd be able to get to this particular repeater by RF means instead of by internet means? KC2ZUM, K2RIW.
For this is also. I just recently acquired a 700 something, a Kenwood 700. I forget the exact model number, but it's a very old rig. It's about 35 years out of production. It's a 2-meter all-user, all-something, all-mode radio, AM and FM and sideband, everything. So I'm going to have to use some kind of a beam to use that. So that's my next project for next weekend, and then we'll try it and see what happens as long as the board allows me to keep my antenna up. Right now I'm working off of a omnidirectional GP1, which is only 15 feet in the air, and I'm lucky to have that up at this point in time. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Alan. I own a Kenwood TS-700A, which has the digital readout, and it is a 2-meter all-mode rig, and it's really all-mode. It includes AM, FM, sideband, upper sideband, lower sideband. It is an all-mode rig, and I believe it's got a power output knob on it also. As I remember, it only puts out 10 watts. So you're going to want an afterburner on there, something like a Mirage Baker 1016 or something like that. You're going to want an afterburner, a Mirage Baker 1016, to take 10 watts in and puts, in theory, 160 watts out, although mine, when it's fed with 13.8 volts from my automobile, will put out not 160 but 180 watts. So the combination of that and a real vertically polarized significant number of elements, 2-meter Yagi at a reasonable altitude, with or without a rotator, I think you stand a high chance of getting from Fishkill to here RF-wise. And as you can tell, getting into this repeater by radio means gives you a slightly higher priority than getting in by way of internet means, whether you do it by Echolink or IRLP, because of the timing problem. Let me drop. Yeah, we're very quick on the push-to-talk switch down here, and people climb on top of each other. One-third of the people who sign in don't wait for the four beeps. So it's a good project. And if you find on a flea market, my favorite 2-meter all-mode rig, which has got quite a bit more quality than the Kenwood 700, is the Kenwood TS-711A. TS-711A. It's a much nicer rig, a much nicer digital design. Has a real digital synthesizer, as opposed to the 700, has a variable frequency oscillator with a big variable capacitor on that main knob. And the problem with that variable capacitor, in my case, is the variable capacitor eventually developed scratchy contacts, even though I tried cleaning it. Setting frequency was a little bit difficult because the big variable capacitor on the VFO, variable frequency oscillator, had the scratchiness to it. Whereas the 711A, again, it's a 25-year-old rig, but sometimes on the flea market they sell for some very nice prices, like around $200. Anything less than $450, in my opinion, is worth it, because to get the exact same performance. And by the way, the TS-711A, just like the 700, has a built-in power supply. It runs on 110 volts. And so it's a real digitally synthesized all-mode rig. It's got everything except amplitude modulation. You'll be a little bit happy with that 30 watts. And the 30 watts is thoroughly variable from the front panel. You can go from about 5 watts to 30 watts by twisting one knob on the front panel. So when you're feeding exciters for the higher bands, very...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As I...
P2ZUM. I'll tell you, it is a TS-700A, and I got it for actually... shape in the original box, the original styrofoam holders and everything, and it was very clean, and original microphone and everything, and yes, it is only 10 watts, and I am thinking about an amp for it. It's just that they're a little steep. I was looking at the Mirage amp. Right now, it's putting out about 8 watts, at least that's what my meter is showing. There is a amp I could use that would probably work with this, but if it goes over 8, I might blow the amp. So I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm doing a lot of simplex with it. No sideband contacts as of yet, but of course, once I go horizontal, that might change. But it is a very nice rig. Everything else that I own here is all modern, either commercial or modern amateur gear. So it is the first in my collection of a more of an antique, I should say, or a much older rig. And very straightforward. And I was just surprised of the condition that it was in. It was in excellent condition. And I'm going to look into that 711A that you were mentioning. And the last thing I just wanted to say, I don't know if it's already being done, but there should be some way or someone monitoring the Echolink side of this thing, John the TechNet, so that somebody would know if there's a problem right away so they can get on it if possible. That's all for me this evening. Let me throw it back over to you and the rest of the group there. This is KC2ZUM.
The repeater went down to send to TDH, Warwick, New York. The repeater still up? Okay, the repeater's back up now. It was down for a short period of time. We're not quite sure why. Pretty fine, Alan. We heard everything. And the 700 that you've got should do the job pretty nicely. Hopefully you don't have the problem I did of the scratchy main variable capacitor on the variable frequency oscillator. And mine had a counter built into it, the 700SB, I think it was, the one with the counter. And so when it started jumping around in frequency, I could tell by the counter going crazy. And if you do get a hold of a 711A, it's a fairly nice rig. It's even nicer than the 700. And to get the exact same performance of modern rigs, 2-meter all mode, base station type, you have to go to like $1,500, whereas the 711, an oldie but goodie, they frequently sell for numbers like $200, $300, and they're very much worth it. Alrighty. Who have we skipped so far? Have I, anybody who signed in, did I forget to get to you guys? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW and the TechNet.
BGB also, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
DEH.
And 60.
Tango Echo Hotel.
60.
Yeah, we got you, Tango Echo Hotel. John first. Go ahead, John.
Dick, maybe you'll want to handle this next week, but I forwarded you an email without trying to simplify it. It's from Scott in Canada. He emailed a question rather lengthy, and it would have been difficult to translate it to you, so I emailed it direct. Whatever you want to do with that, KC2WGB.
Give me a couple of words as to what the subject matter is, John.
It's two questions about a specific antenna. And there's two little quick paragraphs there to read, and you'll be able to give them some updates on that, I'm sure.
Okay. VE3 Tango Echo Hotel, I think it is. If that's who I think it is, Terrence, go right ahead, K2LIW.
Good evening, Dick. Call us November to Tango Echo Hotel, Dave. In Warwick, New York, we'll say good evening to you, good evening to everybody on that, listening to Echolink. And for everybody on Echolink, all you newcomers to hit radio, you don't need to spend the money. I get into this hobby, Warwick is here, except for this rig here, 228H, I come with a 4-element, a Yagi. Okay, yeah, I wanted to say that I have had an odd experience this week, this past week, out in Indiana. I'm a truck driver, and, what had happened was we had a blip, early, I guess it's about a week sometime, I don't know when, but it came, we had it, oh, the heck was it now? It was Thursday, yeah, it was last Thursday, my GPS went off, GPS just, it got quite a snafu, it was sending me in circles, and had to turn it off and go by feel. And what a mess that was. Anyway, yeah, Dick, I got a question too, a couple of questions. Do you believe that terrestrial television is going to disappear as far as right now it's satellite and cable? And also, is it going to exist? You know, look at this one, AMSAT. And it's a question of the nature of it. flashback. What do you think the probability with that rhythm is set to pH?
Hey, stand by a minute, Dave. I've asked that exact same question, Dave, of KE2EJ, and that's Eric Spiegel, who is the chief engineer for Channel 13 and Channel 21, the two PBS stations in the New York City area. Because I, as a over-the-air television watcher, sometimes consider myself a second-class citizen, because the program guide sometimes has got errors and it's blank, the electronic programming guide. And in my particular town, Huntington, Long Island, about 30 miles east of New York City, from all I can tell, I appear to be the only single human being in Huntington that I can find with an aerial on the outside of the house, a television aerial. So in my town, I think I am the only over-the-air television watcher. My aerial, my television antenna, is on the chimney of the house. I keep threatening to put it on the 100-foot tower so I can start doing some real television DXing. According to Eric, there is a rather large number of people closer to New York City, a shorter distance to the broadcast center. Let me drop. There's a much larger number of people closer to the broadcast center that are getting over-the-air television for reasons of their economics or their, or maybe their enthusiasm. They don't want to pay a cable television company. In my case, it's just pure stubbornness. Because I've got a 100-foot tower and I sit on a piece of 300-foot land, which is high by Long Island standards, I can watch television from the four surrounding states, and I do. So I enjoy over-the-air television. The good news is that I get 30 or 40 television channels free of charge, quite a few of them in foreign language. The bad news is I don't get the pay-per-view-like things. I don't get home box office and Showtime and the movie channel and so on. An awful lot of those I do not get. But for the time being, I don't think I need them. I've got other hobbies, if you know what I mean. So, will over-the-air television broadcast disappear? According to Eric, the answer is no. Maybe it's going to be de-emphasized some by comparison to satellite and cable television, whether it be by fiber or coaxial cable. But still, if I had to make a guess, in the New York City metropolitan area, I am guessing that something like 20% of the television watching audience is watching over-the-air television, particularly the people that are a much smaller distance, 10 or 20 miles. But 30 miles away and further, no, they're very rare individuals with high towers. Back to you, Dave. Into Tango Echo Hotel, K2RIW.
Okay, very good pick, very good. Here we have a 735 and 705. happening. I'm having a real good time. And I'll be heading to the U.S. Oh, yeah. One second, everybody. Let me drop it. The Thanksgiving, we will have, there'll be the Fairlawn Radio Emergency Service Auction. And that's going to come following down on Gardner Road in Fairlawn. And the first KJ, I will be there. I'll be there. And it's a lot of fun. More fun than a hit fest. Because you put up some real decent stuff at a reasonable price. Okay, Dick, I got a question. I have a 77 GX Mason.
I'm understanding the question. When it comes to current flowing through a wire,
set is running at radio frequencies. The skin effect means that only the outer 10,000th of an inch at most radio frequencies, for most conductors like copper, only the outer 10,000th of an inch is coupling almost all, conducting almost all of the current. Therefore, the wire appears to have a considerable increase in series resistance when it's part of a coil running at radio frequencies. And now, if that wire is, let's say, a solenoid of wire coil wound around, let's say, a magnetic core, the magnetic field flows through the usual core. If the core had a mu of something considerably greater than air, 1, if it had a mu of 10 or 100, the magnetic field will flow through that core 10 or 100 times better than it does through air. That's what mu means. Therefore, the magnetic field would be more concentrated on the portions of the wider turns of the solenoid coil that are closer to that core. So therefore, I guess you could say the skin effect would have more current flowing on the portion of the wider turns that are closer to the core. That's a guess on my part. This is not an area I've got any real experience at, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
No, I understand that. The skin effect makes the current flow nearby the edge of the wire, so that would be sort of shell. Now, the question character appears to be from the inner diameter of the coil. And the coil doesn't really have to be winded on any kind of core that is magnetic in nature. It is the resistance caused by the effect of proximity in direct ratio to the diameter of the wire, and the resistance caused by the skin effect is inverse proportion. So, there is a certain optimal diameter of the wire for the highest core Q factor. And I assume that on the frequencies 1 to 3 megahertz, the reduced losses in the wires, it is possible to apply large number of wires just to keep a certain Q factor in it. But I didn't really explain it properly. What I'm trying to say is that I got puzzled by the fact that for some reason, even without a core, the current flows in the inner diameter of the coil former. I didn't ask John, but John says that he has an idea what's going on. Maybe John has anything to just help us with. John.
DC2WGB. No, my description would be exactly what Dick just said, concentrated in that area where we were talking about with a core. Now you're saying without a core. So I don't know what effect it would have or why it would concentrate in a crescent. Well, Dick, if you drew a circle on a piece of paper, it looks like, say, the left side would be thicker than the right side. That's his description of what's happening. But our discussion was concerning the core. Other than that, I don't know.
Yeah, the other thing is that I would like to notice is that when we have a core at which we wind the solenoid, the wire, right, then we're dealing from one side of the wire with the seed of dielectric, and from the other one is the seed of the air. If you remember the picture that was made by Hewlett Packard to measure the permeability, it was a sandwich. And then we had a parasitic parasitic in capacitance on the edges of it. Now, I'm trying to think whether the losses in dielectric are caused by that we have a turns of the coil and the capacity that has two components, a capacity through air and the capacity through dielectric. And that reduced capacity through the air is possibly applying some kind of force. I mean, John, help me out.
Dick, let me just ask one quick question to you.
Go ahead, John.
Okay, now he's talking about one turn, no core. If we were to take a coil, let's say we make it a 2-inch diameter, just take the loop, go out and come back, how could the skin effect concentrate to one side of the crescent under those conditions? I don't see that being possible.
The magnetic field that flows in the vicinity of that one turn coil that you just described, if you plotted the equipotential surfaces, in other words, how much magnetic field, there's a lot more magnetic field in the center of the core than there is on the outside of the core. Every one of those lines has to be a complete closed loop, and they do become concentrated in the center. That's just the way the geometry works. And by the way, for most high frequencies, numbers like 3 megacycle or 300 kilohertz, LITZ wire, L-I-T-Z wire, can give you a lot more Q for the same amount of copper. LITZ wire consists of 3, 4, 5, 6 individual fine wires, all insulated from each other, wrapped together as a cable, let's call it, and now you use that cable to wind the turns of your coil. The advantage of LITZ wire is that it has, for the same amount of copper, it has a lot more copper surface area. Since skin effect means that all the RF is flowing on the surface, and since LITZ wire has a lot more surface area for the same amount of copper, you end up with a lot higher Q without using a lot of copper. I could increase the Q of a coil by using larger and larger diameter wire. Eventually, the wire becomes so thick that it's hard to use, and it starts taking up more volume. And most times when you and I use a coil, we have a finite amount of volume to work with. Within that finite volume, you can get more Q, less copper, out of LITZ wire. And so a lot of...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A lot of things like a 2.5 millihenry RF choke, I think they're really wound out of LITZ wire. And I wonder if any of these caduceus coils that you've seen being used, Wes, used LITZ wire for the winding of the coil. N2XJN, K2RIW?
No, we didn't use the LITZ wire. I know what it is. No, we didn't use it, and we didn't really have it handy. We might have tried. So what I'm trying to say is that when you have a former is made from the dielectric material, and the wire is winded on the former. There is no magnetic core in it. Yes, I agree that the concentration of magnetic flux inside the coil is much greater than outside the coil, but we're dealing with two capacitors that would be parasitic capacitance between the two adjacent winds of the coil. One through the dielectric and the other one through the air. Maybe that would partially explain that Christian character. What do you think about it, Dick?
The parasitic capacitance between the turns of the coil doesn't have to be a loss mechanism. A capacitance made in air has no real loss. And if you're using the right kind of a core to wind the coil on, the coil form is a very small amount of material. In other words, the majority of the magnetic field doesn't flow through the core, because the core is, could be a thin material with an air space in the center, and the capacitance between the turns of the coil, that's part of the parasitic capacitance caused by the coil form. If you choose the right materials for the coil form, materials that have a very low loss tangent, like Teflon, like plexiglass, like I can't think of the name of that other material. There are a couple of plastic-like materials that have very high quality, very low electronic loss tangent. As such, although there is parasitic capacitance between the turns, it doesn't have to be a significant loss factor.
Yeah, but Dick, we didn't, in this moment, with the situation in which energy is being stored in dielectric, if we're talking about the capacitor. So, since the air capacitor cannot really store energy in the air, so to say, or say a vacuum cannot store it in a vacuum, then from just the other side we have in dielectric, and that's the nature of the capacitor, isn't that? And to actually,
one turn, so there is no inter-electrode or inter-winding capacitance.
I'm getting to the easiness right now. Two turns, two adjustment turns. Just for a moment, what do you think about it?
But you're jumping around and changing. First you told them one turn, now you're telling them two. Okay, back to you, Dick.
And stand by, Thomas. If I have two metal plates close to each other, in a vacuum, that is a real capacitor. In a vacuum, that capacitor will definitely store energy, 1/2 CV². So I can store electronic energy in a capacitor that consists of nothing but metal and vacuum.
Not in the vacuum, right?
I didn't get the question. It is the charge on the two plates. One plate is going to have an excess of electrons. The other plate is going to have less electrons. The difference between the two, you and I call it charge. 1/2 CV² is energy. So that capacitor built in vacuum is a real capacitor, and it will store energy. Over to you, Wes, KQLIW.
Okay. Yeah, but it's just a medium that energy is being conserved. I'm sorry, the chant that I'm chanting around, I really don't mean it, but say we have two winds, just for one example, okay, and those winds are on the insulator, winded on the insulator. Now, we're dealing with one capacitor from the outside, which is the air, and the other capacitor that is from inside, which is the insulator. Now, we know that in regards to the insulator, the energy is being stored in insulator, not on the plates of the capacitor. But in terms of vacuum, the energy is not being stored in vacuum, which is the space. Dick?
If you're afraid that your insulator, which is storing energy in straight capacitance, and you're worried about the loss of that energy, you can get around the problem.
I'm trying to explain the question nature.
You can wind the two turns in air. You don't. If the wire is stiff enough, you don't need a coil form. And yet you still have real parasitic capacitance between the turns, but that parasitic capacitance has essentially no loss mechanism. Over to you, Wes.
Okay. John, what do you think about it?
I'm confused in the question you're asking, but pick it up with Dick, because I have another issue with it. I know the field is concentrated in the center, but when you said one single turn, okay, you can't have it forming a crescent. That
magnetic field is going to be even all along that wire. I don't see the concentration of electrons in a crescent.
But if we have two lines, John?
I don't know. I didn't think about that. But I don't even think it could happen with two windings, because I'm trying to see if that construct makes sense. Without some type of core that's going to be magnetically contaminated, I don't see that crescent forming.
Well, let me put it this way. Losses in the core are directly proportional to the frequency of power that is transiting through the coil and depend on the core material. So on the high frequencies, the reduction of the losses applied to non-magnetic, say, brass or, say, copper insert, right, and then apply to the air core and the coil inductance without any coil forward. So I'm kind of confused in everything, but I see that definitely the parasitic capacitance in the core, if we have a core, must be present and therefore somehow alter the current that is flowing in the wire, creating the crescent and tertiary.
Well, what if you wound it on a glass cylinder, Wes? You're saying that that dielectric would still cause the crescent? I don't think so. Let me turn it over to Dick. Over to you, Dick.
I guess I'm not quite sure why we're trying to figure out where the crescent is of this concentration of current or current density or magnetic field. Is there a need why we must look at each individual turn of the coil almost microscopically? Is there a reason we have to do that, Wes? Go ahead.
Yes. We're talking about the fundamental explanation of the energy transfer or energy flow, because we're dealing with the electrons. Each electron is a mass in motion, and then by some reason it is being sucked to the inner diameter of the coil. John?
In the case of a coil which has some real amount of inductance and energy storage, 1/2 Li², inductive energy storage, is going to usually, with reasonable design, it's going to dominate. If I've got a coil of wire, whether it be one turn or 1,000 turns, and energy is being stored, I think after you finish analyzing it, you're going to find out that 95% of the energy is stored in the inductance, not in the stray capacitance between the turns. The inductance of a coil as an energy storage medium, inductance dominates. That's my belief. Wonder how you feel about that, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I agree with you, Dick. That's where I believe it is. But I'm confused about the question. I'm not sure a crescent exists without some type of core with high mu. I don't think it's going to exist in air, and I don't think it would exist around glass. Just my opinion. I haven't researched it.
Did we say that the concentration of the magnetic flux inside the core is greater than outside? Dick?
For a whole bunch of reasons, even in air, there's more magnetic field in the middle of the core than the outside. The outside has got a tremendous amount of area. The inside has got very little area, and yet the exact same number of lines must exist in both environments. So for mechanical reasons, for geometry reasons, there's going to be a lot more magnetic field in the center than the outside. John, define the word crescent for me. What's your definition of crescent? Because I keep hearing that word, and I'm not quite sure how we're using it here. You got it, John.
Okay, Dick. Let me let it drop. Okay, crescent, like in a crescent moon. If you took a compass and drew a circle, you'd have a linear line going around 360 degrees. But let's say as you draw it, when it starts to go from the 12 o'clock position toward the 9 and the 6, that side gets thicker. That's the concentration of the electrons on the surface of the wire that Wesley's questioning. I can only see that happening if it's on a permeable core. I can't see it in air or on glass. No matter how you structure that, that field is going to be evenly distributed, I feel.
With your compass, you drew a circle starting at 12 o'clock. You went through 9 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and back to 12 o'clock. And you made the wire, you made the circle thicker near 9 o'clock and thinner near 3 o'clock. The circle that you've drawn, is that the circle that represents one turn of a coil, or is that the cross-sectional area of the wire that makes up a one-turn coil? Which is it? Over to you, John.
That is the cross-section of the wire, and it's from the 12 o'clock, it doesn't matter, but it's, I would make it start to gain thickness from 12 o'clock heading towards 6, passing through 9. The thickest would be at 9 o'clock. Now that is looking at the wire end on. So when you wrap that around a cylinder with some mu, you'll see the concentration. That's what Wesley's talking about. I don't see that in air or on a glass cylinder. I don't think that exists.
It might.
Okay, for what reason?
One turn of coil in air or in a vacuum, because we are fairly sure that there is a stronger magnetic field in the center of the one-turn coil than there is on the outside. If there's 1,000 lines of magnetic field, and every one of the 1,000 lines must go through the center of the one-turn, but the 1,000 lines can spread out in all kinds of ways when it comes to outside of the coil to complete. That was technet number 4125. Be kind to each other, you guys. Technet 4125. 73, you all. Bye-bye. We'll see you next week. K2LIW. Over to you, John.